By the time all but one of the missing parts were eventually located, the starship Titanic was within sight of the planet Yasica. Returning home was always the jailer's favourite thing in life. Soon he would have his feet up beside a blazing hearth. A jug of old-fashioned beer would be in his hand, and his family would be running here and there, preparing the evening meal or playing games on the porch in the setting sun. He was therefore whistling a rather jolly tune as he unlocked the cell door and indicated to Dan that he was a free man. Had Dan been more musical, he would have recognised the jailer's tune as none other than Mademoiselle from Armentières, a French tune popular during the First World War. The reason why the jailer came to be whistling it is not unconnected to the smuggling of French champagne to Bléontine via the time warp previously mentioned. For, if the truth were known, the jailer was none other than Corporal Pillywiddly Pillipitit, the notorious smuggler and leader of the infamous Pillywiddly Pillipitit gang, which was one of the unpleasant manifestations of organized crime that had sprung up since the ruin of the Yassican economy. Pillywiddly Pillipitit had disguised himself as an ordinary corporal in the Yassican space fleet in order to reconnoitre the starship Titanic for possible plunder at a later date. But that is another story. The moment he was free, Dan made a beeline for Lucy, who was standing on the captain's bridge with the journalist and Nettie, watching the great globe of the approaching planet through the window.
"Lucy," he whispered, "can we go and talk somewhere private?"
"Not now," Lucy whispered back. "Look, isn't that the most amazing sight you've ever seen?"
"It reminds me of your breasts," murmured the journalist.
Dan managed to hold himself back, and instead of nearly killing the journalist on the spot, he grabbed Lucy by the arm and dragged her to the other end of the bridge.
"You threw yourself at him. He said you did."
Dan was trying to sound more indignant and accusing than plaintive, but it was coming out more like a total and utter whinge.
"Dan, it was just a weak moment."
"Why, have you never had any weak moments with me in 13 years?
"Just what the hell are you talking about, Dan? We have a great sex life, don't we?"
Lucy was getting mad at him.
"Well, yes, it's just..."
"You're so goddamn jealous! You think I'm screwing every man who finds me attractive!"
"Oh, no, I never said that."
As usual, Dan could feel the conversation spiralling out of his control. As it happened, however, he was rescued from the inevitable dialectical humiliation by a remarkable and dangerous turn of events that was to alter the whole course of this story. Bolthas had been pointing out the continents and countries of Yassica to Nettie. He felt his heart beating fast, partly with the pride he felt in his own world, but more because Nettie had taken hold of his arm, and was now beside him, gazing out of the window in wonder and admiration. Bolthas could have practically swooned on the spot. He could smell the scent of that beautiful creature beside him. He could feel the gentle touch of her soft hands upon his arm, and he could feel her heart beating behind her firm breast close against him. Bolthas hardly knew what he was saying.
"And there, dear lady, you can see the ocean of summer plastering. That is the land known as fine pottery. Oh, and over there, dear lady, if you were to turn your eyes, you can see my own country, Carpenter's Islands. It is a fine place, peopled by noble craftsmen and technicians of the highest quality. Oh, at least it was before."
Bolthas's voice seemed to crack so that Nettie glanced down at him. His rugged features were clouded by a furrow of sadness.
"Before what, Captain Bolthas?" Nettie asked softly.
"Ah, Nettie, I don't want to burden you with the problems of our world," replied the gallant captain.
"I should like to know."
Nettie took the captain's hand in hers and stroked it gently,
and I think the good captain would have fainted then and there for sheer pleasure, had not a movement around the perimeter of the planet distracted him.
"Warden, what's that?"
Bolthas had suddenly become tense. The navigational engineer peered into the distant haze around Yassica. He put his binofocals to his eyes, and an involuntary gasp escaped him.
"Bléontinians!"
Bolthas grabbed the binofocals.
Yes, he could see, clearly, a whole fleet of fighter spaceships with Bléontinian registration plates, but no other markings. They were clearly not official Bléontine space fleet.
"Mercenaries," muttered Asmal.
"They mean trouble," said Yelin.
"Quick," yelled Bolthas, "every man to arms, and turn off the SD feature. We shall shoot real ammunition."
There was a buzz amongst the Yassicans as they leapt into action, grabbing weapons and racing to predetermined positions.
The idea of firing real ammunition instead of simulated destruction charges was both terrible and exciting. It was one thing to use live ammunition against the outside hull of the starship, but shooting live rounds actually inside the ship would mean damage on a grand scale. There would be an enormous amount of exciting repair work to look forward to. Balthus's face suddenly darkened, and he turned gravely to Nettie.
Nettie, I am so sorry to do this, and I hope you will be able to forgive me. But I must, regretfully, ask you and your friends to retire to a safe quarter, whilst we are engaged with the enemy.
While Balthus had been saying this, the Blerontinian mercenaries had streaked, at just under light speed, up to the starship, and had now surrounded it. There must have been 50 or 60 craft, a typical ragbag assortment of spaceships converted to military use. Such ad hoc fleets had become a familiar sight in the space skies around this sector of the galaxy, ever since the breakdown of economic cooperation between worlds and the destabilization of the Intergalactic Security Council. Suddenly a harsh voice boomed out over the starship's loudspeaker system.
This is the official space fleet of the Magna Corps Insurance Company of Blerontin. We are acting under license, and according to Blerontinian law, on behalf of the loss adjusters appointed to liquidate the remaining assets of the Starstruck Construction Company, Starship Titanic Holdings Limited, and Starlight Travel Inc. On behalf of the above-named insurance company, we hereby repossess this starship as lawful property of the said insurance company. Please leave quietly and in an orderly fashion.
Snork piddlers, yelled Balthus. He knew how to work the voice system, and his voice rang round the mercenary spaceship.
We built this ship. We lavished our care and craftsmanship upon it without stint and without grudge. We bought the finest materials and ran into debt trying to meet the wonderfully high specifications ordered by Mr. Leovinus. We were never paid a penny. Then, when the construction was taken from us, we and our families were faced with poverty and hunger. This ship is ours by every moral right in the galaxy. What is more, we claim it by right of salvage. We found it, and we have brought it back to its rightful place. Go suck yourselves!
Even as he spoke, four of the mercenary boarding craft were clanged into the side of the starship. Grappling irons were attached to the hull, and the airlocks of the Titanic were broached from the outside. At the same moment, the air around the mercenaries burst into light and smoke and noise as the Yasikans launched a furious counterattack. All this while, Nettie, Dan, Lucy, and the journalist had found themselves back under arrest and being hurried towards the cells by half a dozen agitated Yasikan guards. They were about halfway along the Grand Axial Canal when an advance patrol of Blerontinian mercenaries suddenly burst out of the embarkation lobby and opened fire. The three Earth people and the journalist threw themselves onto the floor, but the Yasikans, used as they were to SD weapons, hesitated for a second, and in that second they lost it. Corporal Inchby Wiglet and Corporal Kazitinka Rigapittle made it to the deck, but Corporals Yarktak, Bunsleywater, Tidoloft and Forzab received direct hits. They clutched their chests, and their weapons clattered to the floor. Nettie was the first to throw herself onto one of the fallen weapons, and without hesitation she turned it on the mercenaries. Considering she had never even handled a shotgun back on Earth, Nettie seemed to master the Yasikan blaster with remarkable ease. It seemed obvious to her where to hold it, and she'd noticed the trigger just below one of the firing chambers. She aimed it, squeezed the trigger, and flame blasted out of the barrels, and two mercenaries fell to the ground.
No, no, yelled Corporal Inchby Wiglet in alarm. Aim above their heads!
Not on your life, yelled Nettie, and brought down another Blerontinian. By this time, Lucy, Dan, and the journalist had each grabbed hold of another of the spare weapons and started blasting away at their attackers. Their Yasikan guards were clearly shocked. The Blerontinians, for their part, were taken totally by surprise. They were used to standing up to the fury of Yasikan SD guns, and, in extreme circumstances, they were used to Yasikans firing over their heads. But this was something new. It was also very alarming. The few Blerontinians who remained standing looked at their fallen comrades. They looked back at their adversaries, who even now were blasting straight at them, and, without waiting for another volley to hit them, they turned and fled. The Yasikan guards were flabbergasted. Never in the history of their nation had Blerontinians fled before Yasikan gunfire. Nettie, meanwhile, had raced forwards to the doors of the embarkation lobby. There she continued to blast away at the retreating Glarontinians, but the mercenaries were already back in the airlock and had slammed the door shut.
"Mind the paintwork!" gasped Corporal Inchby Wiglet.
"Well done!" cried Dan, who had just reached Nettie. She was breathing hard, and Dan could feel the heat coming off her body as he stood close behind her. Suddenly she spun round.
"Oh, my God! The bomb!"
She pulled the mobile phone from her pocket.
"Two," said the bomb. "One."
"Hi, Bomb, it's Nettie."
"Hi, Nettie."
"Are you all right, Bomb?"
There was silence. For a moment, Dan thought they'd lost it.
"Bomb, are you there, Bomb?"
Nettie called into the phone. But still, the bomb didn't reply. Dan grabbed the phone.
"Bomb."
"Oh, of course, let the man do it," said Nettie.
Dan wasn't listening to Nettie.
"Bomb, are you there? Speak to me."
"I was speaking to Nettie," said the bomb in a sulky voice.
"Oh,"
Dan handed the phone back to Nettie, "sorry."
"This is Nettie."
Again the bomb remained silent.
"Bomb?"
Again silence.
"Bomb!"
A note of urgency had crept into Nettie's voice.
"Speak to me!"
Then the bomb spoke, very quietly.
"I'm Omega Scuttler."
"Is that your name?" asked Nettie.
"Yes," said the bomb. "I'm a bomb."
"I know you are," replied Nettie.
"I like hearing your voice, Nettie."
"I like hearing yours, Bomb."
"You're not just saying that."
"No, I'm not. For an electronic voice, you have a very soft one. It's nice." For a moment, Nettie thought the Bomb was crying.
"Won't you start counting down again for me?"
"If you'd really like me to."
"Oh, yes," said Nettie.
"Very well," said the Bomb. "I'll count. Just for you, Nettie. But this is the last time. 1,000. 999.
Nettie had been so intent upon her purpose of stopping the bomb that she hadn't realized how terrified she'd been. But the next moment she found out. Her knees gave way, and she fell into Dan's arms that were suddenly there to catch her. Bolfas stood on the captain's bridge of the starship Titanic and could not believe his eyes as he watched the Blerontinian mercenaries beat a retreat into their boarding craft.
"What on yassica's going on?" he exclaimed.
"Blerontinians don't just give up like that. They usually fight to our last man."
But for good measure he ordered another salvo of spacefire, and the blackness around the mercenaries' craft exploded again with light and noise. In less time than it takes for a snork to poop on a plate, the ragtag flotilla had turned about, and with a blast of white-hot rocketry the Los Adjusters space fleet disappeared into the stars beyond the beautiful green planet of Yassica. At that very moment, Dan and Nettie burst onto the captain's bridge again.
"You should be in the cells,"
snapped Bolfas.
"They shot straight at the enemy,"
Corporal Inchby Wiglet had suddenly appeared behind them.
"That's why the mercenaries ran off."
"We've got to do something about the bomb," cried Nettie. "It says this will be its last countdown."
Bolfas looked very grave indeed.
"You aimed directly at the Blerontinians," he said.
"Well, is that what you meant to do?" asked Nettie.
"No, it is not," exclaimed Bolfas. "We have a strict moral code. My dear lady, I'm sure you didn't mean to actually aim at them."
"Well, of course you did." Dan was getting a bit short-tempered. "It's the only way to stop them. What are we going to do about the bomb?"
"They ran off like Zippo as soon as they realized Nettie was firing at them," exclaimed Inchby Wiglet enthusiastically.
"I shall have to put you all under arrest."
"Captain Bolfas," said Nettie in her most charming voice, "we are ignorant of your ways on Yassica, and can only react as Earth people. And on Earth, I'm afraid, people aim to kill and maim each other. That's what weapons are for. I don't like it, but that's how it is. We didn't mean to infringe your code of honor. We just tried to save you and the starship from the Los Adjusters. Now listen." And she flipped on the mobile phone.
922.
The bomb was still counting.
"We've got 13 minutes.
"Very well," said Bolfas, still stern-faced. "We shall have to apologize to the Blerontinians."
"But they were trying to kill you," exclaimed Nettie.
"That is because they have no moral code that forbids them," replied Bolfas with undeniable logic. "I shall write the letter of apology as soon as I get a spare moment."
"If we don't do something about the bomb," exclaimed Dan, "we're all of us going to be nothing but spare moments."
"You are right," said Bolfas. "I shall have it defused at once."
Nettie insisted on being with the bomb while it was defused.
I feel I owe it to it, she said when Dan tried to dissuade her. Besides, if it goes off, it doesn't matter where on the ship any of us are.
The Yaskin bomb disposal expert agreed as he put his tool bag down beside the bomb.
434, said the bomb.
Hi, bomb, said Nettie.
433, said the bomb.
Nettie somehow knew it was not going to let itself be interrupted. This was the last countdown.
How are you feeling, bomb? Nettie asked.
Please don't talk to it while I'm defusing it, said the bomb disposal expert. It could be dangerous.
Have you got enough time? Asked Dan.
432, said the bomb.
Depends, said the bomb disposal expert, unscrewing a metal plate from the cabinet. If it keeps counting at this speed, I should be okay, but sometimes on the last countdown they can speed up. This is an 8D96 full-force megascuttler. If it was an 8G or even a 9A, we'd be fine. They put a servo-control mechanism in to stop that problem, but with the 8D, well, you just never know. This seems to be all in order.
While he had been talking, the bomb disposal expert had removed the metal plate and exposed a dull red button which read, Defuse the Bomb.
Fortunately, on the 8D, they still included this automatic diffuser, just to make it simple for us bomb disposal experts. He pressed the button. Immediately, the bomb stopped counting. There was a pause. Then a siren went off. The red button saying, Defuse the Bomb, lit up and started flashing, and a glass cover slid across the button, preventing anyone from touching it.
Wait a mo, said the bomb disposal expert. This doesn't seem to be quite right.
Congratulations, said the bomb. You have successfully defused the 8D96 full-force megascuttler. The megascuttler, however, is linked into the intelligence cyber system of this starship, and unfortunately, that system is currently incomplete. The bomb has therefore gone into default mode. Please refer to manual.
Where's the manual? Asked the bomb disposal expert, his voice betraying an edge of what Nettie, although she desperately tried to find a more comforting word, could only categorise as panic.
Oh, you're the bomb disposal expert, said Dan helpfully.
Meanwhile, Nettie had discovered a small booklet tucked under the bomb cabinet. She riffled through the pages.
How to preset the timer for cooking large joints, she read.
Oh, that's the manual for the gas oven, exclaimed the bomb disposal expert, grabbing it off Nettie and starting to read it avidly.
Any technical manual was of interest to a Yasakan. It was the sort of thing in which they could always find solace and escape, especially when under pressure. Meanwhile, Dan and Nettie scoured the engine room for the right manual. By the time the bomb disposal expert said, Look, it has the self-cleaning function! Dan had found the easy-to-use manual for the 8D96 full-force megascuttler, your user-friendly bomb, stuffed behind some water pipes.
The 8D96 full-force megascuttler is designed to be the ultimate user-friendly exploding device, he read. All operations are simple and self-explanatory.
Oh, give me that, cried the bomb disposal expert, snatching the manual from Dan's hands.
A default mode, he read. Once the bomb has gone into default mode as a result of an incomplete intelligence system on board ship, the following conditions will apply. You will not be able to reach the defuse button. You will not be able to touch the bomb or the bomb cabinet. You will not be able to do anything any more to the bomb, so leave it alone. Do you understand? Good. The 8D96 full-force megascuttler will now explode in exactly 6 Dormillion days from the commencement of default mode.
Shit, said Dan.
Shit, said Nettie.
Shit, said the bomb disposal expert.
How long is a Dormillion day? It was Nettie who was the first to ask the obvious question.
36 Dormillion hours, said the bomb disposal expert.
How long's a Dormillion hour? Asked Dan.
78 Dormillion minutes, said the bomb disposal expert. It's about, well, how can I tell you? There's no point of reference.
The three of them thought for some time and were just about to agree that it was impossible to convey any idea of time from one star system to another when Nettie said, Got it! Now, I won't tell you how she worked it out, but it was pretty clever. If you can't work it out for yourself, you'll have to write to the publishers of this audiobook for a self-explanatory leaflet entitled How Nettie Worked Out the Length of a Dormillion Day. So, 6 Dormillion days must be roughly equivalent to 10 Earth days, said Nettie after a few quick calculations.
God, Nettie, said Dan, you're so clever. Why didn't I think of that?
The trio had just reported back to the bridge of the starship.
How do we get it out of default mode?
Bolfast was questioning the bomb disposal expert. Our only hope is to find the missing central core of the ship's intelligence, said the bomb disposal expert. If we can replace that, then I can probably defuse the bomb. Otherwise, it'll blow in 6 Dormillion days.
Bolfas turned to his assembled crew.
Men, you hear the seriousness of this situation. Our beloved home of Yassica has been ruined by the construction of this starship and the failure of the Blerontinians to honour their debts. We built in good faith. We put our entire way of life at risk to construct the most fabulous and beautiful starcraft the galaxy has ever seen. The Blerontinians betrayed our trust. The only chance our world has of returning to its former prosperity is by our repossession of the starship Titanic. If it is blown up by this treacherous bomb, the future of our world is grim indeed. Therefore, I command you to search this ship again. I know we have scoured every last inch of it, but that Central Intelligence Corps must be on board somewhere, and we must find it.
At this moment, a scream was heard over the loudspeaker system.
Lucy! Exclaimed Anne.
I have to explain what had happened to Lucy and the journalist since the brief exchange of gunfire outside the embarkation lobby. The moment Nettie, Dan, and Corporal Inchby Wiglet ran after the retreating Blerontinians, the journalist grabbed Lucy and pulled her into a side chamber off the Grand Axial Canal.
"What on earth are you doing there?"
exclaimed Lucy, although it was pretty obvious that the journalist was undoing the buttons of her pinstripe power suit as fast as he possibly could, whilst at the same time apparently trying to see how far into her ear he could stick his tongue.
"Ugh!" cried Lucy. "Stop it!"
"No, no, no," moaned the journalist. "Once we Blerontinian males have been aroused by a female, it takes us many, many years, sometimes a lifetime, to get de-aroused vis-à-vis that particular female."
"What are you saying, the?" cried Lucy.
"Marry me, Lucy," cried the journalist, burying his face in her now exposed bra.
"Oh, yes, 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 the," she screamed.
"Squawk!" screamed something else.
"We can get engaged and have a white wedding and a wedding cake, and Dan can give the best man's speech, and we'll have a honeymoon," exclaimed the journalist.
"Squawk!"
"Darling, the," cried Lucy, tears in her eyes. "What am I doing? What am I saying?"
Part of Lucy's legal training had suddenly started to reassert itself. It was something on the lines of, "Don't commit to anything that you may later regret."
But I'm getting married to Dan. We're going to run a hotel. What was that squawk?"
"Squawk!" said the thing that was squawking. "It was that," exclaimed the journalist. And suddenly a large parrot flew out of the dark recesses of the room and landed on the journalist's shoulder. It was at that moment that Lucy screamed. And as she screamed, as luck would have it, she had inadvertently put her hand down on one of the ship's intercom buttons, with the result that her scream was relayed all round the starship Titanic.
"Squawk!" said the parrot. "Bloody genius!"
Back on the captain's bridge, Bolfast pricked up his ears.
"What did that parrot say?"
"Bloody genius!"
screamed the parrot over the intercom.
"Parrot!" yelled Captain Bolfast. "What are you telling us?"
Why is Captain Bolfast so interested in what a parrot says? Nettie had turned to Corporal Inchby Wiglet.
"In Yassican tradition," whispered Corporal Inchby Wiglet, "parrots are the messengers of truth. We have a saying, from the mouths of babes and parrots."
"Parrot!" Bolfast yelled into the intercom. "We're looking for the missing Central Intelligence Corps for Titania's brain. Do you know where it is?"
There was a silence.
"Parrot!" yelled Bolfast.
But Lucy had removed her hand from the intercom button and was now using it to caress the journalist's face as if his smooth features were fortune-teller's crystal ball. She had no idea why she had said yes to everything he'd just suggested, and she thought she had probably made a terrible mistake. If only she could see the future in those strange orange-coloured eyes of his.
"You're crazy," she said.
"Oh," moaned the journalist, and he chewed her bra strap with his teeth.
"Ah,"
said Lucy.
"Ah," murmured the journalist.
"Aha," replied Lucy.
"Oh,"
he said.
"Oh, ah, oh,"
added Lucy.
"Yeah, ah, ah,"
asked the journalist.
"Ah,"
confirmed Lucy.
"Ah?"
asked the journalist again.
"Ah!"
repeated Lucy.
"Oh!"
The journalist was almost lost for words at this point, but Lucy carried on the conversation.
Oh,
she said.
Ah.
He wondered how she could be so certain.
Ah.
She was absolutely certain now.
Ah.
And at that moment, the entire company from the captain's bridge burst into the side chamber off the Grand Axial Canal and stood riveted to the spot while they watched a highly qualified lawyer from Wilshire Boulevard and an underachieving member of the Blerentinian press corps doing the sort of things to each other that give inexpressible delight and pleasure to the participants, but which only tend to provoke ridicule from casual observers, and about which, therefore, I will not go into detail. Suffice it to say that the moment the bridge party burst into the room, the parrot gave the loudest squawk it had given up to date, and Lucy fell off the table onto the journalist's face.
"Lucy!" exclaimed Dan.
"Parrot!" yelled Bolfas. "Where is the missing intelligence corps for Titania's brain?"
"Bloody genius!"
squawked the parrot.
"Don't talk rubbish!" shouted Bolfas.
"Bloody genius!"
screamed the parrot.
"I ask you a question!" yelled Bolfas.
Also, according to Yassican tradition, parrots were supposed to answer any questions put to them.
"Squawk!"
The parrot momentarily forgot its powers of speech.
"Answer my question!"
"Squawk!"
The parrot flew off the journalist's shoulder, where it had managed to keep its perch, despite all the passionate goings-on with Lucy, and disappeared into the shadows at the further end of the chamber.
"Damn it!"
Bolfas knew it was bad luck if a parrot refused to answer your question.
"I can explain everything," Lucy was telling Dan.
"No, you can't. You can't explain anything," screamed Dan.
And Lucy suddenly thought, "He's right. He's absolutely right. Perhaps that is your answer." It was Nettie who had suddenly stepped forward and taken Captain Bolfas by the arm.
"Dear lady, it is good of you to trouble yourself with this matter, but I fear the parrot has not given any reply. I am doomed."
"But didn't you tell me that this starship was designed by some genius?"
"Leovinus!" exclaimed the journalist. "He was here on the ship when we crashed on Earth.
Or maybe he has the missing part." It was all so clear to Nettie, although she didn't know why.
Something clicked in the journalist's mind.
"Of course," he exclaimed. "When Leovinus ran off the ship, he was brandishing this glowing silver shard in his hand."
"The Central Corps Intelligence!" exclaimed Bolfas. "That's why it isn't on the ship!"
He was putting two and two together, but rather slowly. Nettie decided to take over the deduction process.
"In order to get the missing Central Intelligence Corps for the ship's system, we've got to find this Leovinus character. Leovinus is on the Earth, but we can't get to the Earth because we don't know where it is, and the only way to find out where it is to get hold of the missing Central Intelligence Corps and refit it into Titania's brain. Gentlemen, we're screwed." It was then that the docking siren sounded. The starship Titanic was preparing itself for landing on the planet of Yassica. The celebration party was a gloomy affair. Everyone tried to make the best of it and kept toasting the Earth folk for their invaluable help in beating off the insurance loss adjusters. Several speeches were made extolling the return of the great starship to its rightful home. But nobody could forget that within a couple of days the ship would have to be towed off to some distant part of the galaxy, where it could explode without doing any more harm than destroy itself. The Yassicans could see no prospect of recovering their economy. Meanwhile, Lucy, Dan and Nettie could see no prospect of ever returning to their own planet. They'd each been given translation blisters, like small plasters worn behind the ear, so they could still communicate now they were away from the influence of the ship's automatic systems. But that had done little to reconcile them to the prospect of exile on an alien world.
"But surely,"
Rodden, the navigational engineer, had cornered Nettie,
"you must have some idea of where this Earth place is. I mean, you must at least know whether it is in the notional northern hemisphere of the galaxy or the notional south."
"Well, no."
"Is it on an outer or an inner arm of the spiral?"
I haven't a clue," said Nettie.
Rodden shook his head gloomily. He hated talking to dumb blondes.
"Well, if you really have no idea where you've come from, I really can't get you back there. The only thing that could is the starship, and that can't remember because its brain's missing. Seems to be a common complaint," he added unnecessarily, and wandered off, rather to Nettie's relief.
Nettie looked around at the gloomy party. She felt sad, and yet there was so much beauty in this gentle world she found herself in. Yassica. Oh, it's a nice name for a start. And she was sure there were worse places. Slough, New Malden, Basingstoke. Nettie found herself split in two. One part of her was saying, "Come on, make the best of it. This is home from now on." And the other half was telling her not to give up, that somehow, deep down inside her, she was convinced that she would be able to get them all back to Earth. Nettie felt a bit foolish for feeling so convinced of her own ability, but there it was. She just couldn't shake the feeling off, though she had no idea why she had it. In the meantime, she tried to enjoy the sad celebration. The very smell of the snork roasting over open fires seemed sad, as it wafted under the gloomy Yassican pines, and then mingled with the softer, sadder scents of the night jasmine and the weeping oleanders that crowded Corporal Gullhollowell's garden. The Yassicans took it in turn to host important national events, and it just happened to be Corporal Gullhollowell's turn. He had provided 7 snorks for roasting, plates of fish and fruit, and fresh vegetables from his garden. Unlike the Blarentinians, the Yassicans took no interest in canapés, and preferred good, plain food, washed down with plenty of Yassican ale and sweet potato wine. The journalist gloomily thought it all pretty poor fare, but he tried to hide his contempt for the lack of fish paste, tiny chicken vol-au-vents, and cocktail sausages on sticks. But no matter how much Nettie complimented him on his crackling, Corporal Gullhollowell refused to emerge from his gloom. "In the old days," he explained to Nettie, "we would have roasted 70 snorks. I would have been able to provide so much fish we could have filled the ocean of summer plastering. And all the beer and wine, well, it would have flowed from those fountains you see over there in the centre of the garden. Ah, oh, these are thin times indeed for Yassica." And he gloomily stared into the empty ale mug he held in his hands. Captain Bolfass was also gloomy. He kept trying not to stare at Nettie, who had discarded her Gap T-shirt, hand-knitted waistcoat and miniskirt, in favour of a simple Yassican shift, slit up to the thigh and embroidered at one corner. She looked breathtaking, and the poor captain's breath was so taken that he sighed and tried to imagine how he could ever have lived without her.
"Who are you mooning over now, Captain Bolfass?" asked his wife.
"Oh, excuse me, my dear," replied Bolfass. "It is just that young earthwoman has stolen my soul with her beauty."
"Poor dear," said Mrs. Bolfass, taking his hand and stroking it. "I'm sure you'll get better." On Yassica, being in love was considered a form of illness.
"Oh," sighed Captain Bolfass, "I do hope so. I do hope so."
"Perhaps you should see Dr. Poncallywack."
No, I'll be all right," sighed the captain.
But the old Yassican songs that the band were now playing caused the captain to sigh again and again, and even brought a tear to his eye. They were ancient songs of yearning for better tools and materials, songs of lament for construction projects that were never finished, and songs of regret for the great craftsmen of yesteryear who would never plane nor chisel again. Lucy found Dan hidden at the far end of the garden, sitting on a low wall under the oleanders, sunk in utter despondency. He held a piece of snork crackling in one hand, and a glass of wine in the other.
"Go away," he said.
"Oh, Dan!" Lucy sat beside him and tried to put her arm round him.
"Let's get married."
"Married?" exclaimed Dan. "After what I saw that alien doing to you?"
"Oh, don't be..."
Well, Lucy wasn't quite sure what she was telling Dan not to be. Foolish, jealous, sulky. He had a right to be all those things, and yet she couldn't help feeling he was overdoing it.
"Dan, we love each other, don't we?"
"I don't know," replied Dan. "Do we?"
"Of course we do," cried Lucy. "We're going to set up the hotel and run it together and have children."
"No, we aren't," said Dan. "We can't get back to Earth, and even if we could, the hotel's a pile of rubble."
"But we've got the money from Top 10 Travel."
"But that doesn't mean we love each other."
"But we do. We've been together all this time."
Dan stared gloomily at the piece of snork crackling in his hand. Finally, he looked at Lucy and said,
"Here comes Nettie."
Nettie had been looking for Lucy and Dan all over the garden.
"May I join the funeral?" she said.
Dan nodded, and Nettie sat down on the other side of him. Lucy took her hand away from Dan's. "So," Nettie began, "I suppose this is going to be home from now on."
"You look as though you've made yourself at home already," remarked Lucy, who was still wearing her earth clothes.
"I thought I might as well start getting into the role," laughed Nettie.
"That is so sensible," said Dan, to Lucy's intense annoyance.
"Look, I don't want to break you two up,"
said Nettie, even more to Lucy's intense annoyance. "But I've got something to tell you, something I think you ought to know." Nettie didn't quite know where to begin. "It's about the rectory, your hotel."
"It's sad to think we'll never be able to run it after all, Nettie."
Dan sighed into his wine.
"You were never going to be able to run it," replied Nettie.
"What do you mean?"
Lucy was immediately on the defensive.
What was Nettie implying? That they were incompetent or something?
"I don't know whether I should tell you this now. Maybe it's pointless. But, on the other hand, maybe it'll make you feel better."
"What?"
demanded Lucy. She had stood up and folded her arms in her best courtroom, "How do you dare propose that?" posture. "Well," said Nettie, "Nigel was a shit. We all know that."
"He was my best friend," exclaimed Dan.
"Yes, sure," replied Nettie, "but he was a shit."
"Well, you certainly let him treat you like shit," retorted Lucy.
"Well, that's my problem," replied Nettie. "I'm crazy. But that doesn't mean I'm stupid. And although Nigel never discussed any of his business with me, I can tell you he didn't sell top 10 travel for anything like the amount he told you he had. That's why you could never get the documentation off him. He actually sold it for peanuts. You'd never have been able to pay off the rectory, let alone set up the hotel." There was a brief silence that seemed to get up, stretch its legs, and then wander off into the night.
"Huh," retorted Lucy eventually. "That doesn't surprise me one little bit."
"Well, it sure surprises me," exclaimed Dan. "How do you know this, Nettie?"
He felt incredibly indignant. Probably indignant at Nigel, but for the moment he was content to be indignant with the messenger.
"Oh, he was so sloppy. He used to just leave documents lying around. I guess he never bothered to talk to me enough to find out that I was bright enough to see what he was up to. I kept trying to tell you, but we never met except with Nigel in tow. It was awful. I could see you heading for disaster."
"That bastard!" cried Lucy, striding around beneath the oleanders. "If we ever get back to Earth, I'm going to tear his balls off!"
"Well, that's one threat he doesn't have to worry about," sighed Dan, his depression deepening by the second.
Suddenly he felt Nettie's hand on his arm. He turned and looked directly into her eyes, and felt his stomach give way. A wave of wonderful helplessness swept over him as he felt her eyes falling into his. And yet she was saying something else. Dan couldn't make out what it was that Nettie was saying. He was so overcome with her proximity, and the way her breasts showed through the translucent muslin of her Yassican shift. The next moment, before he had regained his senses, she had rushed off in some excitement. Dan turned to Lucy.
"What did she just say?" he managed to ask.
"She just said, 'Wait a minute, I've got it, I've got the answer, I knew I would,'" replied Lucy.
"Oh," said Dan.
There was a silence. Then he added,
"I'm sorry about the hotel. I know how much it meant to you."
Lucy looked at him in some surprise.
"I was more worried for you. I know you'd staked everything on it."
Dan frowned and took a little swig of his wine.
"That's why I went along with it," continued Lucy. "I never really liked that rectory. I just couldn't bear for you to be disappointed."
Dan took another little swig of his wine. Then he did something that was so uncharacteristic that it made Lucy jump out of her skin. He threw his glass against one of the oleanders, and it shattered into tiny pieces.
"Well," he said, "in that case, I guess we've both been fooling ourselves and each other for a long time. I was only so keen because I thought you were."
Lucy was playing with one of the buttons that had come off her pinstripe power suit during her earlier encounter with the journalist.
"Maybe that says it all, Dan. Maybe that says it all."